brazen non-sequiturs made TV celebrities of each. But outright lying is a high-risk media strategy. Among the things that made the early Trump White House press briefings such fascinating viewing was the ever more open disdain of the assembled journalists for Sean Spicer and the ever tartar sarcasm of their follow-up questions. Rather than contest this battle, the Trump administration increasingly avoided it. White House press briefings were taken off camera, then closed even to recording devices, then cut to less than a quarter of an hour. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson refused to allow journalists to travel with him, creating an absurd situation in which the American public often learned about the actions of the Secretary of State from the controlled media of foreign authoritarian governments. The avoidance strategy, however, also had its limits. It is not as if the press vanishes when an administration declines to speak. The press continues to ask, and sooner or later, somebody will answer. The Trump administration, among the least intentionally communicative presidential administrations in history, also quickly proved the leakiest. An AP report of May 13, 2017, wonderfully conveyed the irony. Trump is said to be seething over the flood of leaks pouring out of the White House and into news reports. He's viewed even senior advisors suspiciously, including Bannon and Priebus, when stories about internal White House drama land in the press. A dozen White House officials and others close to Trump detailed the president's decision-making and his mood on the condition of anonymity in order to discuss private conversations and deliberations. All presidents chafe against their press coverage. Donald Trump actually has less to complain about than almost any of his predecessors. No president, not Barack Obama, not John F. Kennedy, has benefited more from slavish and sycophantic coverage from the media organizations that influence his supporters the most. Fox News, Breitbart, Newsmax, and the English-language propaganda outlets of the Russian state, Sputnik and RT. It often seems that, like Stalin's cabinet ministers, Fox News's hosts compete to offer the most abject flattery to a president who watches more TV than any other in history. Even with more independent-minded media, Trump got better coverage than he might have expected. The practices and taboos of traditional media forbade them to report on many things discreditable to Trump, but deemed by them not of legitimate public interest. Much that might have been embarrassing in Trump's personal and family life went unreported for these reasons. The traditional media's commitment to both sides of the story created within them an insatiable internal demand for positive comments about a president about whom there was otherwise so little good to say. On cable and on prestigious op-ed pages, nothing was a surer path to prominence than devising some, any, praise or defense of Trump. Hence the desperate hunt by CNN for pro-Trump talking heads. Hence the weird participation trophies that even Trump skeptical commentators awarded the president when and if he behaved in a relatively normal way for a few consecutive hours. "This was presidential. This was big league stuff," said CNN's David Gergen after Donald Trump's first face-to-face meeting as president with Vladimir Putin. "He became president of the United States in that moment, period. There are a lot of people who have reason to be fearful of him, to be mad at him, but that was one of the most extraordinary moments you have ever seen in American politics," said CNN's Van Jones after Trump paid tribute to the widow of a Navy SEAL in his first speech to a joint session of Congress. President Trump, however, did not notice or appreciate this bias in his favor. He raved and raged and seethed in self-pity. His clack at Fox and on talk radio agreed with and amplified him. The United States used to champion rights and liberties around the world. In his July 2017 trip to Warsaw, however, Donald Trump stood side by side with Polish President Andrzej Duda and joined him in a joint attack on press freedom. Trump opened with an attack on CNN and NBC. despite the fact that I made them a fortune with The Apprentice, but they forgot that. He then turned to the Polish president and asked him, "Do you have that also, Mr. President?" Duda smiled and agreed. Duda's party had politicized Poland's state broadcaster, converting it into a propaganda outlet for the governing party, and then banned independent media organizations from reporting inside the Polish parliament. The outright ban had to be abandoned in the face of public protests, but stringent restrictions on the coverage of both parliament and the courts remained in place. CNN's Tom Clute asked a White House spokesperson for comment on this apparently unprecedented attack on the free media by an American president on foreign soil, and received the following answer. "This is a president who was elected by the American people for telling it like it is, and he will do that no matter the setting, unlike many in the media and political circles who change their messaging based on the audience and venue. Furthermore, the media certainly has no problem attacking the president on the global stage." Elected leaders normally accept press criticism as part of the job. Trump could not endure even a taste of it, a vulnerability mockingly commented upon by Vladimir Putin at their first post-election face-to-face meeting. The journalist-murdering Russian leader jerked a thumb at the American press corps and slyly asked Trump, "Are these the ones who have hurt your feelings?" Restrictions on media freedom are an early warning sign of de-democratization in declining democracies. Turkey, once the great hope for democratization in the Islamic world, detained hundreds of journalists during the April 2017 referendum campaign to concentrate power in the hands of its authoritarian leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Hungary's Viktor Orbán politicized his country's state broadcaster and used government advertising to bring privately owned print media under his party's control. South Africa's state broadcaster refuses to cover protests against the governing African National Congress and has fired journalists who defy its ban. India's Narendra Modi forced a liberal TV channel off the air for 24 hours in November 2016, to punish it for allegedly compromising national security. More than on any other issue, more than on taxes or health care or immigration or trade or anything else he supposedly cares about, President Trump has made it his supreme and highest priority to defame those who responsibly and accurately report his tenure of his high office. What Donald Trump wants is more bias, not less. More fake news, not less. What he demands from the media is not objectivity, but complicity. And from the right-of-center media, complicity is what Trump is getting. Trump is doing all this with the acquiescence of the institutional Republican Party and the support of conservatives across the country. What we are seeing here is not merely one man's petty ego needs on display, although we are certainly seeing that. What we are seeing is a grant of permission from millions of people to the President of the United States to diminish, discredit, corrode, and ultimately subvert what the authors of the U.S. Bill of Rights listed among the very first freedoms necessary to their great experiment in self-government. Chapter 7. Rigged System. A record 137.5 million Americans voted in 2016, reported the Pew Research Center after the fact. That achievement, however, was marred by some odd discrepancies. African American electoral participation has steadily risen over the past decades, reaching a peak of more than 65% of those eligible in the presidential election of 2012. 4 years later, only 58% of eligible black Americans cast a ballot, a decline unprecedented in modern times for any American ethnic group. Perhaps black voters were uninspired by Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Young black voters voice doubts about Clinton, reported the New York Times on September 5, 2016. On the other hand, similar headlines could surely have been reported about John Kerry in 2004. Yet African Americans turned out for Kerry in greater percentages than for Hillary Clinton. Something else happened to dampen African American participation in the election of 2016, and that something was the surge of Republican victories at the state and local levels during the Obama presidency. Republicans entered the 2016 cycle controlling all elected branches of government in half the states in the country, their best showing since the 1920s. Democrats controlled only 7 states, their worst showing since Reconstruction. Among the first uses to which Republicans put their ascendancy was revising state voting procedures. Between 2010 and 2016, some 20 states rewrote their laws in ways that made voting more difficult, often with blatantly partisan effect. For example, 6 states cut back on early and weekend voting. Early voting encourages voting by minority voters who tend to have less control over their working hours. By contrast, mail-in ballots preferred by the elderly and by military personnel, and historically the most fraud-prone element of the American electoral system, went untouched. 10 states instituted new voter identification rules, again often with partisan effect. Texas, for example, allowed only 7 forms of identification. A concealed carry permit was acceptable. A photo ID from the state university system was not. Of the 20 states that raised new difficulties to voting during the Obama years, only 6 did so in time for 2012, 14 in time for 2016. One of the most consequential of the pre-2016 changes occurred in Wisconsin, a must-win state for Republicans, the abolition of the state's special registration deputies, individuals certified by the state to check proofs of eligibility and add names to the voter rolls. These deputies had played a critical role in minority registration drives in the city of Milwaukee. In their stead, Wisconsin instituted a system of online registration more convenient to those with computer access and savvy, and a stark impediment to those who lacked either or both. Mike Pence's Indiana did not lag far behind. An August investigation led by Fatima Hussein of the Indianapolis Star found that Republicans used their control of state and local government to reduce early voting options in Center City, Indianapolis, and expand them in the Republican suburbs to the northeast. Early voting stations in GOP-leaning Hamilton County were multiplied from 1 to 3. In Democrat-favoring Marion County, they were cut from 3 to 1. Result? While early absentee voting rose by 63% in Hamilton between 2008 and 2016, it tumbled by 26% in Marion. Options were expanded in other Republican counties as well, helping to shift the state from Obama's Democratic column in the presidential election of 2008 back to Romney and Trump in 2012 and 2016. Enabling many of these changes was a 2013 Supreme Court decision, Shelby County v. Holder, that put an end to the most biting section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. That section required 9 states, Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, as well as some 40 counties in states including California, Florida, New York, and North Carolina, to gain pre-clearance from the Federal Department of Justice for changes to their voting rules. At the time Republican-led states adopted their new voting rules, Donald Trump's candidacy for president was imagined by virtually nobody. Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker hoped that the 2016 Republican presidential nominee might be himself, but the new system was positioned for Trump to use and to weaponize with some special measures all his own. Throughout their existence as members of a self-governing republic, Americans have fused a deep conviction that here the people rule with a deep ambivalence about who exactly should be enumerated among the people. This ambivalence has never been resolved, and if anything, seems to have become more intensely felt over the past quarter century. The same Marist poll quoted in the previous chapter that showed that 43% of Republicans thought the country had gone too far in protecting the rights of the media also showed that a quarter of them believed the United States had gone too far in protecting the right to vote. As the country has become polarized between rich and poor, and as the white majority in the United States has dwindled, a mood of anxiety has gripped those who feel themselves vulnerable to new demands on the state. This anxiety was eloquently expressed by Paul Ryan's 2011 Tipping Point speech. America is drawing perilously close to a tipping point that has the potential to curtail free enterprise, transform our government, and weaken our national identity in ways that may not be reversible. The tipping point represents two dangers. First, long-term economic decline as the number of makers diminishes and the number of takers grows. And second, gradual moral political decline as dependency and passivity weaken the nation's character. The same thought was expressed more crudely the next year by Donald Trump Jr., who in October 2012 tweeted, "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers it can bribe the public with the public's money," a remark he spuriously attributed to Alexis de Tocqueville. The elder Trump articulated the same apprehension for the future in a September 2016 interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network's David Brody. "I think this will be the last election if I don't win. I think this will be the last election that the Republicans have a chance of winning because you're going to have people flowing across the border. You're going to have illegal immigrants coming in and they're going to be legalized and they're going to be able to vote. And once that all happens, you can forget it. You're not going to have one Republican vote, and it's already a hard number. Already the path is much more difficult for Republicans. You just have to look at the maps." It was not out of the ether that Donald Trump confected his post-election claim that he lost the popular vote only because millions voted illegally. Such claims have been circulating in the Republican world for some time, based in some cases on purported statistical evidence. Beyond the evidence, however, was fear. Fear that the time would soon come, and maybe already had come, when democracy would be turned against those who regarded themselves as its rightful winners and proper custodians. That fear can legitimize actions that once would have seemed utterly unacceptable, anti-democratic, un-American, verging on the treasonable. Through the 2016 campaign, Trump had denounced American democracy as a rigged system, rigged against him specifically by a small handful of global special interests. Trump's final campaign ad, released on November 6, 2016, showed three faces to illustrate those global special interests: the financier George Soros, the head of the Federal Reserve Janet Yellen, and the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein. A voiceover intoned, "It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities." The Anti-Defamation League issued a worried statement about this closing appeal. "Whether intentional or not, the images and rhetoric in this ad touch on subjects that anti-Semites have used for ages. This needs to stop. In the final days before the election, tensions are extremely high. It's a time when all candidates need to be especially responsible and bid for votes by offering sincere ideas and policy proposals, not by conjuring painful stereotypes and baseless conspiracy theories." But for some Republicans, Trump's rigging claims represented an opportunity rather than an embarrassment. Trump followed up his ungrounded claims of widespread illegal voting by forming a presidential advisory commission on electoral integrity under Vice President Mike Pence. The commission's strongest personality, Kansas's Secretary of State Kris Kobach, had long argued that U.S. elections were corrupted by illegal voting and that the proper remedy was the frequent and aggressive purging of voter registration rolls. Duplication of voter registration is an endemic feature of American life. A young person born in one state who attends school in another, finds a first job in a third, and then settles down in a fourth, could leave a trail of registrations behind her because nobody invests much energy removing people from registration rolls when they leave a state. On the other hand, there's very scant evidence that this duplication of registration leads to duplication of votes. While it's theoretically imaginable that our itinerant young person could fraudulently request absentee ballots from states 1, 2, and 3, the lawbreaking would require considerable effort. Absentee ballots are typically sent by U.S. mail only to the recorded street addresses, so the fraud-minded voter will have to arrange some kind of multi-state collection service. To ascertain whether a Juan Garcia Gomez who cast a ballot in Kansas is the same person or different from the Juan Garcia Gomez who voted in Nebraska requires much more specific information, such as a social security number. State law, however, typically protects individual voter information. For that reason, 15 states refused to cooperate with the Pence Commission, contending that its requests for voters' names, birth dates, and social security numbers violated state law. Those states were Arizona, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Mexico, New York, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Tennessee, Virginia, and Wyoming. Others signaled negative responses soon to come. Arkansas, Hawaii, Illinois, Louisiana, Maryland, Montana, and Rhode Island. The majority of the states that did offer cooperation with the commission insisted that they would provide only publicly available information, not including social security numbers, for example. Wisconsin added that it would provide the federal government publicly available information only on the same terms it provides voter information to political parties, on payment of a fee of $12,500. But of course, the publicly available information would not advance the commission's case very far. Vexed, President Trump angrily demanded in a July 1, 2017 tweet, "Numerous states are refusing to give information to the very distinguished voter fraud panel. What are they trying to hide?" The answer to that presidential question quickly became obvious as the White House was forced to acknowledge that it lacked a secure means to store voters' information. It would be too grimly ironic if a White House project to stop voter fraud instead created a centralized database of voter information that hackers could access to enable voter fraud. This fear is not at all a hypothetical concern. The Russian effort to subvert the 2016 information did not stop at fake news. Hackers attacked state voting systems, too. 150,000 attempts just in the state of South Carolina. Like the invading Martians in H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, who are ultimately laid low by humble earthly diseases, the Russian hackers were impeded by the decentralized chaos of American voting systems. If election-critical information is centrally stored, however, it will have to be effectively secured. The competence record of a White House that routinely misspells names, bungles titles, and makes crude factual errors in the course of wrongly accusing others of factual errors is not reassuring. I write this book, and perhaps you read it, at a time when many details of the Trump-Russia collusion remain unsettled. Yet the essential elements of the transaction have been apparent since the summer of 2016. Russia mounted a costly and aggressive espionage campaign to help elect Donald Trump and congressional Republicans and to defeat Hillary Clinton and congressional Democrats. Donald Trump's son, son-in-law, and campaign manager privately met with Russian spies offering damaging information about Hillary Clinton. If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer, replied Donald Trump Jr. to the offer of Russian aid, an offer that specifically referenced Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Trump's team of foreign policy advisors in 2016 was led by people who had received pay from the Russian state or state-controlled businesses. Most troublingly, and without overstepping what has yet been proved, it certainly looks as if the Trump campaign coordinated its strategy and messaging with Russian-sponsored hacking and disinformation efforts. But the culpability does not stop with Donald Trump, his family, or even his campaign. In December 2016, The Washington Post reported on what had happened when congressional leaders were briefed on the Russian hacks earlier that year. In September, during a secret briefing for congressional leaders, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, Kentucky, voiced doubts about the veracity of the intelligence, according to officials present. In a secure room in the Capitol used for briefings involving classified information, administration officials broadly laid out the evidence U.S. spy agencies had collected, showing Russia's role in cyber intrusions in at least two states and in hacking the emails of the Democratic organizations and individuals. And they made a case for a united bipartisan front in response to what one official described as the threat posed by unprecedented meddling by a foreign power in our election process. The Democratic leaders in the room unanimously agreed on the need to take the threat seriously. Republicans, however, were divided, with at least two GOP lawmakers reluctant to accede to the White House requests. According to several officials, McConnell raised doubts about the underlying intelligence and made clear to the administration that he would consider any effort by the White House to challenge the Russians publicly an act of partisan politics. Some of the Republicans in the briefing also seemed opposed to the idea of going public with such explosive allegations in the final stages of an election, a move that they argued would only rattle public confidence and play into Moscow's hands. The Obama administration observed increasingly assertive Russian attacks on European political systems as early as 2014. For reasons we will learn from the memoirs its members write, the Obama administration hesitated to respond. Was it to protect its Iran diplomacy, a hope it could mollify Russia into ending aggression against Ukraine, a more general aversion to forceful foreign policy, overconfidence in the robustness of democratic political systems, including its own? Whatever the motive, the results are as we have seen. Warnings were issued to Russia, but no action was taken during the election, and only very limited penalties applied afterward. Most notably, the seizure of two Russian diplomatic compounds. By then, it was too late. A president beholden to Russia had been installed in the Oval Office, the most successful foreign espionage attempt against the United States in the nation's history. And from beginning to end, the president's political party rallied to protect him and itself from investigation, exposure, and consequences. I'll be the first one to come out and point to Russia if there's clear evidence, declared House Intelligence Chair Devin Nunes in December 2016. Instead, over the following months, Nunes actively collaborated with the Trump White House to sabotage his committee's investigation, to the point where he was forced to recuse himself from further involvement. House Speaker Ryan issued multiple statements viewing Russia's behavior with alarm in 2016. But Ryan took a firm stance from the beginning against anybody digging too deep into what had happened. As we work to protect our democracy from foreign influence, Ryan said in a written statement of December 12, 2016, we should not cast doubt on the clear and decisive outcome of this election. When in June 2017, the Senate voted 97-2 to limit President Trump's ability to lift sanctions on Russia, Ryan whipped votes in the House to block that measure. An amended version of the June sanctions bill did pass both houses at the end of July and was signed by President Trump in August. The sanctions remained unimplemented as of October 1, 2017. Even supposed Russia hawks like Senator Marco Rubio came to Trump's aid when it counted. At the June 8, 2017 public hearing for the fired FBI Director James Comey, Rubio used his public airtime to try to extract admissions that would discredit Comey and exculpate the president. Remember, Trump himself had acknowledged in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt on May 11th that he had fired Comey precisely in order to put an end to the made-up story that Russia helped him win the election. Trump's motive for firing Comey was no longer a matter in dispute, yet it was Rubio more than any other senator on the committee who endeavored to distract from that undisputed fact. Rubio. But the specific ask was that you would tell the American people what you had already told him, what you had already told the leaders of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, that he was not personally under investigation. Comey. Yes, sir, that's how I, Rubio. In fact, he was asking you to do what you have done here today. Rubio. So, in essence, the president agreed with your statement that it would be great if we could have an investigation. All the facts came out and we found nothing, so he agreed that that would be ideal, but this cloud is still messing up my ability to do the rest of my agenda. Rubio. So are those the only two instances in which that sort of back and forth happened, where the president was basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's okay, do the Russia investigation. I hope it all comes out. I have nothing to do with anything Russia. It'd be great if it all came out, if people around me were doing things that were wrong. Rubio. You know, this investigation is full of leaks, left and right. I mean, we've learned more from the newspapers sometimes than we do from our open hearings, for sure. You ever wonder why, of all the things in this investigation, the only thing that's never been leaked is the fact that the president was not personally under investigation, despite the fact that both Democrats and Republicans in the leadership of Congress knew that and have known that for weeks? That last sentence, it should be noted, was the single most often heard pro-Trump talking point of the period. Rubio dutifully reprised it for the watching world. The truth outed, as truth tends to do, especially with Trump's stumble-bum crew. The line written into the script of All the President's Men about Watergate applies even more forcefully to the Trump family and its entourage. The truth is, these aren't very bright guys, and things got out of hand. But it is also true that the wrong actions of Donald Trump and his family were protected before the fact and condoned after the fact by the larger Republican and conservative world. I jokingly tweeted at the end of May that after all the excuses condoning Greg Gianforte's assault on Ben Jacobs, we would next be called on to explain why treason is bad. That joke all too quickly proved prophetic. Geraldo Rivera opened the excuse-making on the May 10, 2017 Hannity show. If the Russian KGB chief is talking to Paul Manafort and the chief says, you know, I've got this dirt here that says Hillary Clinton was this or that, and Paul Manafort says, next Wednesday, why don't you release that? That'd be great for us. I don't know that that's a crime at all. What's the crime? In a conversation with me on the May 21, 2017 edition of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS, the pro-Trump author Ronald Kessler said, there's no violation of law if, in fact, the campaign colluded with Russia, whatever that means. The conservative radio host Michael Reagan said the same thing in a CNN discussion on May 31st. Collusion is not breaking the law. On his June 22, 2017 television program, Sean Hannity and former Speaker Newt Gingrich agreed that it would be a positive benefit to the United States if Trump had worked with the Russians against Hillary Clinton. If I worked for President Trump and his campaign and I thought the Russians had information that would expose Hillary for being a liar and I said, could you release that? Is that a crime? Hannity returned to the theme on his radio program the next day. What was the collusion? That maybe somebody in the Trump campaign talked to somebody in Russia because Russia supposedly had the information that Hillary Clinton had destroyed on her server when she committed a felony and tried to cover up her crimes? Is that a crime to say, release it, to show the truth, to show damaging information? The former Fox anchor Britt Hume similarly absolved the Trump campaign on the June 25th Fox News Sunday. While it obviously would be alarming and highly inappropriate for the Trump campaign to, of which there's no evidence, by the way, of colluding with the Russians, it's not a crime. Some went further still, wondering why anybody need worry about Russia at all. The news media in the West pose a far greater danger to Western civilization than Russia does, tweeted the radio host Dennis Prager on July 14, 2017. Whether collusion with a Russian espionage agency would violate U.S. election laws raises complex issues of legal interpretation. The national security implications, however, are straightforward and grim. A candidate who had received help from a hostile foreign power would depend hugely on that power's goodwill. What if they released evidence against him? They could wreck his presidency, provoke an impeachment crisis, possibly send him to prison. He would have to govern himself very circumspectly, even at political risk to himself at home. Collusion between a U.S. president and a hostile foreign power would constitute the gravest espionage crisis in American history, and one of its blackest pages of treason. The below timeline of relevant events was compiled by NBC News, abridged by me with some interpolations highlighted. June 9, 2016. Donald Trump Jr., along with Jared Kushner and Trump's former campaign chair Paul Manafort, meet with the Kremlin-connected lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya. June 9, Trump tweets for the first time about Clinton's missing 33,000 emails. July 18, The Washington Post reports on the first day of the GOP convention that the Trump campaign changed the Republican platform to ensure that it didn't call for giving weapons to Ukraine to fight Russian and rebel forces. July 21, highlighted. Trump gives an interview to David Sanger and Maggie Haberman of the New York Times in which he repeatedly refuses to commit to defending NATO's Baltic allies Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia against Russia. July 22, WikiLeaks releases emails stolen from the Democratic National Committee. July 27, in the final news conference of his 2016 campaign, Trump tells Russia, "If you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." August 4th, Obama's CIA director John Brennan confronts his Russian counterpart about Russia's interference. October 4th, WikiLeaks' Julian Assange says his organization will publish emails related to the 2016 campaign. October 7th, the Department of Homeland Security and the Director of National Intelligence release a statement directly saying that Russia is interfering in the 2016 election. October 7th, highlighted. The Washington Post reports the Access Hollywood video. October 7th, WikiLeaks begins releasing emails stolen from Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta, highlighted, less than 1 hour after the Washington Post report. October 31st, this WikiLeaks is like a treasure trove, Trump says on the campaign trail. November 4th, boy, I love reading those WikiLeaks, Trump says from Ohio. All this may be coincidence, a sequence of misunderstandings, but it does not look good for the integrity of the American political system. The authoritarians of older times abolished elections altogether or falsified them so outrageously as to render them meaningless. Modern authoritarian states do not so explicitly renounce the democratic idea. Even Vladimir Putin's Russia has elections in which millions of people vote, and it's not at all obvious that Putin cheats very much in the counting of that vote. In the Russian parliamentary elections of September 2016, Vladimir Putin's party won a perfectly plausible 54% of the vote, on the basis of a turnout that the regime candidly described as the lowest since the end of communism. In Putin's system, if you have to cheat in the vote counting, you've left things far too late. And Putin's is the most repressive of the world's de-democratizing states. The others, places such as Hungary, the Philippines, South Africa, Turkey, and so on, distort the election processes even less, although just enough to preclude unwelcome results. In modern authoritarian states, unapproved candidates are deterred from running. Disfavored people are discouraged from voting. Votes may be counted honestly enough, but voting systems are tilted in favor of the party of the leader. In the Hungarian elections of 2014, for example, the party of the prime minister won 133 out of 199 parliamentary seats, with only 44.9% of the vote. In such states, state resources are directed in ways that support the party of the leader. State-owned and state-influenced media spread disinformation and defamation about opponents. Rather than discuss issues, ethnic grievances are stoked, and when outsiders report on what is happening, the regime exploits the opportunity to denounce a hostile external world for defaming the nation. Americans regard their democracy as beyond comparison to such sad international cases. Yet here, too, the democratic system was and is harshly contested. The right of all adult citizens to vote is no longer seriously debated by Americans, but the universal ability to vote seems to encounter new obstacles with every passing year. If Donald Trump entrenches himself in power, those obstacles will rise higher and proliferate more numerously across the American political landscape. The fear that the younger Donald Trump inserted into Tocqueville's mouth, that a democracy can last only until citizens discover they can vote themselves benefits, actually originated nearer to home. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the majority discovers it can vote itself largesse out of the public treasury. After that, the majority always votes for the candidate, promising the most benefits, with the result that democracy collapses. Those oft-quoted words, also sometimes attributed to Aristotle and Thomas Babington Macaulay, seem to have originated in a 1951 op-ed in the Daily Oklahoman by a retired Wisconsin state senator. What's interesting about those words is not how prescient they are, but really how opposite to the truth. In the United States, as in other countries, the great threat to constitutional democracy has not been the demands for largesse by the many, but the fears for their property of the few. The most successful anti-democratic movement in American history, the reduction of voting rights after Reconstruction, was intended precisely to thwart local majorities voting themselves such benefits as schooling and paying for it by higher taxes on the rich. The rollback worked, too. Only 50,752 ballots were cast by the 1.7 million people of South Carolina in the election of 1924, half as many as cast by 700,000 South Carolinians in 1872. Connecticut, with 300,000 fewer people than South Carolina in 1924, cast eight times as many votes. Now, in the 2010s, the integrity of American democracy is challenged again, and again the challenge is backed by threats of armed violence. In June 2017, a rumor spread via Facebook that protesters planned to rally at a park in Houston, Texas, to demand the removal of a statue of Sam Houston. Hundreds of supporters of the statue rallied, a large number of them carrying rifles, some wearing body armor. Herman Park, the site of the Sam Houston statue, is one of the city of Houston's most visited parks. The Houston Zoo is located within it. The Children's Museum of Houston stands just a few blocks away. On weekends, the park is typically crowded with young families. Yet some dozens of Texans decided that this would be an appropriate place to plan a gunfight. And of course they were entirely within their rights, as those rights are understood in 21st century America. Texas law forbids citizens to carry deadly weapons in a manner calculated to alarm. Otherwise, long arms may be shouldered by virtually anyone in almost any place. It might be thought that bringing a rifle into a playground is itself calculated to alarm, but over the past generation, gun carriers have become much more assertive and the authorities much more accommodating. Gun carriers at the so-called Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August 2017 acted more like a paramilitary force than as individual demonstrators. They wore pseudo-military outfits, including body armor. They took tactical formations to surround the site of the expected confrontation, although when murder was done ISIS-style, by ramming a car into a crowd of demonstrators. The City Council of San Antonio, Texas, met in August 2017 to debate removal of a Confederate monument from that city's Travis Park. 10 men bearing assault rifles and wearing Kevlar vests took positions outside the council's chambers. The open display of military-style weapons at public meetings is not an ancient right cherished by Americans through the centuries. Among free men, Abraham Lincoln famously wrote, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet, and that they who take such an appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet just such a threat is what is being issued in Houston and Charlottesville and San Antonio, and more places yet to come. The following happened in Loudoun County, Virginia, on Election Day 2016. A man wearing a Donald Trump shirt and carrying a weapon stood outside a voting location in Loudoun County, Virginia. I had my 9-year-old son with me. I felt intimidated, Erica Cotty said, and I had to explain to my 9-year-old why a man with a .357 Magnum is standing outside the polling station. Cotty said the man offered her a Republican sample ballot, which she declined. He's like, "Who are you going to vote for, Crooked Hillary?" And I was like, "That's really none of your business," Cotty said, adding that the man was standing in the sidewalk outside of the office when they left and blocking their path. Will there be more such incidents in 2018 and 2020? It's all quite legal. In many Americans' minds, the right to carry arms is now the master right of American law, to which all other rights must yield. In 1994, the average gun-owning household owned 4 weapons. By 2015, the average gun-owning household owned 8. At a press conference in the lobby of Trump Tower 2 days after the violence in Charlottesville, Trump channeled the feelings of the men who carried guns to prevent an elected government from putting lawful decisions into effect. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name. The new name to which Trump objected was Emancipation Park. A week later still, at an August 22, 2017 rally in Phoenix, Arizona, Trump again identified himself with those defending Confederate monuments by force of arms. "Yes, by the way, they are trying to take away our history and our heritage. You see that?" Through the 2016 campaign, Trump had condoned political violence by his supporters against protesters in their midst. "You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks." Back then, however, the cause was purely personal, his own election, unconnected to any larger movement in American society or culture. As Trump's personal popularity sagged, he sought larger and bigger forces to sustain him. Speaking to police officers in Long Island, Trump endorsed intentional police brutality against members of Salvadoran gangs, whom he condemned as animals. "They kidnap, they extort, they rape and they rob. They stomp on their victims, they beat them with clubs, they slash them with machetes and they stab them with knives. They have transformed peaceful parks and beautiful quiet neighborhoods into blood-stained killing fields. They're animals." When dealing with such subhumans, the police should dispense with legal niceties, urged the president. "When you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough, and I said, 'Please, don't be too nice.' Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over, like, 'Don't hit their head,' and they've just killed somebody, 'Don't hit their head,' I said. You could take the hand away, okay?" Those remarks drew what was described as wild applause from the police attending, and even though the president's words were promptly repudiated by senior police leaders across the nation, those who shared a national origin or a skin tone or a last name with the people Trump regarded as animals must wonder, Has the President of the United States authorized such actions against me as well? The American economic system might feel rigged against Trump supporters, but the American political system of 2016 had in important ways been rigged in Trump's favor. Yet as Trump and his supporters looked to the future, how secure could they feel? Their hold on the electorate was weak. Foreign governments' hold over them was possibly very strong. Maybe the answer, the only answer, was not to rig less, but to rig much more. Chapter 8. America Alone. America First doesn't mean America alone. Gary Cohn and H.R. McMaster, President Trump's highest-ranking economic and national security aides, offered that assurance in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal at the end of May 2017. They were too sanguine. Month by month through the Trump presidency, the United States found itself more isolated from its former friends and allies. Through the spring and summer of 2017, President Trump escalated his rhetoric against North Korea. The escalation culminated in a blood-curdling interview with Reuters on April 27th. There is a chance that we could end up having a major, major conflict with North Korea. North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen, he told television cameras in the Cabinet Room on August 9th. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea, Trump told the United Nations General Assembly on September 19th. Yet even as he pushed toward conflict, Trump himself was gratuitously threatening and insulting the single country whose cooperation would seem most obviously necessary to any tough policy on North Korea. South Korea. It would be South Korea that would do most of the fighting, most of the dying, most of the suffering, and most of the paying in the major, major conflict Trump spoke of so lightly. And yet in the very same Reuters interview in which Trump menaced North Korea, he embarked on an angry rampage against the South. He announced intentions to cancel the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. It's unacceptable. It's a horrible deal made by Hillary. It's a horrible deal, and we're going to renegotiate that deal or terminate it. He demanded an additional $1 billion payment from South Korea for a missile defense deployment already negotiated, reneging on a deal stipulating that the United States would provide the weapon system if South Korea provided the land. I said, why are we paying? Why are we paying $1 billion? We're protecting. Why are we paying $1 billion? So I informed South Korea it would be appropriate if they paid. Nobody's going to do that. Why are we paying $1 billion? It's a $1 billion system. It's phenomenal. It's the most incredible equipment you've ever seen. Shoots missiles right out of the sky, and it protects them, and I want to protect them. We're going to protect them. But they should pay for that, and they understand that. It should surprise nobody that neither of these complaints had much truth to it. South Korea is threatened less by North Korean missiles than by the thousands of North Korean artillery tubes aimed at Seoul. Military experts believe the North could reduce the South's capital to rubble within 24 hours. The Terminal High Altitude Aerial Defense, THAAD system over which Trump haggled in public with South Korea, is positioned south of Seoul, primarily to protect U.S. bases in the Korean Peninsula. Hillary Clinton had little to do with the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement, a framework inherited from the George W. Bush administration, was revised in 2009 and 2010 by President Obama's trade negotiators to provide more protection for the U.S. automobile industry against Korean imports. What happened next should also surprise nobody. The South Korean presidential election 10 days after the Reuters interview was decisively won by the more U.S. skeptical candidate, who promptly suspended deployment of the THAAD system for which Trump had tried to shake his country down. Only 2 weeks before, the Trump administration had stumbled into a farcical embarrassment. Interviewed on Fox Business on April 12, 2017, Trump had announced that he was sending an armada, very powerful, into Korean waters to warn the North against making trouble. 6 days later, the U.S. Navy posted online a photograph of the fleet in question, the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson and four other warships, 3,500 miles away and heading in the opposite direction, southwestward through the Sunda Strait into the Indian Ocean. The most conservative and America-friendly of the three Korean presidential candidates, Hong Jun-pyo, ventilated the fiercest anger against his false-tongued ally. What Mr. Trump said was very important for the national security of South Korea. If that was a lie, then during Trump's term, South Korea will not trust whatever Trump says. Trump had already irritated Koreans by credulously repeating to the Wall Street Journal the chauvinist claim by China's president that Korea actually used to be part of China. For reasons nobody in Korea could discern, and nobody in the United States either, President Trump seemed intent on belittling, deceiving, and making public fools of them. But if they could not guess his motives, they could still resent his treatment. At the end of President Obama's term, according to the Pew survey, 88% of South Koreans expressed confidence that the U.S. president would do the right thing in world affairs. In June 2017, only 17% of South Koreans expressed such confidence in President Trump. South Korea reacted more angrily than many other allied countries, but not radically so. Among citizens of other Asia-Pacific allies, 78% of Japanese had expressed confidence in Obama, only 24% in Trump. 84% of Australians trusted Obama, only 29% Trump. That latter number might have been even worse for Trump if the poll had been conducted after the August 3, 2017 leak of a January telephone transcript in which Trump told Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that he found it more pleasant to talk to Vladimir Putin than to the leader of America's truest and militarily capable Asia-Pacific ally. Only in the Philippines did a majority, 69%, trust Trump, and even there a higher percentage, 94%, had trusted Obama. America's southern neighbors have long mistrusted the power of the United States. Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States, goes the saying usually attributed to the Mexican ruler Porfirio Diaz. In 2013, 38% of adult Mexicans described U.S. power as a potential threat to their country. In the first year of the Trump presidency, that number vaulted to 61%. The European numbers looked even more dismal. In a span of months, trust in the U.S. president to do the right thing dropped by 43 points in Italy, 57 points in the United Kingdom, 70 points in France, and 75 points in Germany. The Trump-Germany relationship started bad and got worse. November 9th is the most portentous date in the German calendar, the day the Kaiser abdicated in 1918, of Kristallnacht in 1938, and of the opening of the Berlin Wall in 1989. On that morning in 2016, the German government awoke to the news that its American partners and protectors had elected to the presidency an authoritarian nationalist of an all-too-familiar stamp. German Chancellor Angela Merkel released as faint and hedged a message of congratulation to President-elect Trump as one ally has perhaps ever offered another. Germany and America are bound by common values, democracy, freedom, as well as respect for the rule of law, and the dignity of each and every person, regardless of their origin, skin color, creed, gender, sexual orientation, or political views. It is based on these values that I wish to offer our close cooperation, both with me personally and between our country's governments. Note two things about this message. Its offer of cooperation is conditional, and Germany will be the judge of whether the conditions have been met. America's allies around the world always have preferences in U.S. elections. In 2004, Germany's Gerhard Schröder and France's Jacques Chirac did not conceal their hope that George W. Bush would lose to John F. Kerry. In 2012, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu visibly yearned to see the back of Barack Obama. Still, once it's